North Idaho News of the Week is brought to you in part by Evergreen Realty, commercial and residential property listings. Online at evergreen-realty.com. Good morning. You've tuned in to North Idaho News of the Week. It's Friday, October 27th, the last Friday of the month of October. I'm Jack Peterson here with Chris Bessler, and we are joined this morning by Zach Hagedon of the Sandpoint Reader. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jack.
And good morning, Zach.
Good morning, Jack.
Well, thank you. It is a chilly one today and this week. The weather has finally turned here in North Idaho, and our Sandpoint Sound is related to that. But we can start by, I guess, running down the top stories of the week here. Here's what I have in front of me. Out in West Bonner County, it sounds official that Superintendent Brandon Durst's time at the helm of the West Bonner County School District has come to an end. The West Bonner County Board of Trustees appointed a temporary superintendent on Wednesday night following their acceptance of a resignation of an unnamed employee. It was presumed to be Brandon Durst's resignation, but trustees never said his name in the open meeting. Joe Kren was appointed to a 90-day contract as superintendent and agreed to hire legal counsel to negotiate the terms of the resignation with the unnamed person. Kren is a former Priest River High School principal and superintendent of the St. Mary School District. And did I hear correctly that he was superintendent of the year in 2016? Is that what you said, Chris?
The Idaho Association of School Administrators named him superintendent of the year. So he has good credentials.
And he was sitting there at Priest River High for all this time. Just waiting to be.
He's currently at Priest River High. He was principal there till 2020.
So
I think he's been retired or doing something else for a couple of years.
At the county level, Luke Ahmet is now officially the chairman of the Board of Trustees. That happened last week. He had been acting as chairman of the Bonner County Commission. He was officially the vice chair and chairman. Steve Bradshaw has now stepped down, and Luke Ahmet is the chairman of the Bonner County Commission. The county has agreed to an external audit of the fairgrounds, and County Prosecutor Lewis Marshall's office has kind of entered the conversation there to kind of determine what the legal requirements were and are for the county and for the fair board. The prosecutor's office technically representing them both because they're both county organizations. Trestle Creek decision delayed. We won't know until Monday what's going on with the Trestle Creek development. I think the Idaho Department of Lands was supposed to issue their decision on this past Monday, and it will now be next Monday. There was a hearing on Camp Bay. The Camp Bay deal on Wednesday, and that drew a good response, and a lot of people attended. I don't know the results of that, though. Did anyone follow up on that at all?
We don't have more on that at this point. I don't, anyways.
Yeah. No, we didn't get a chance to cover that one this week.
Okay.
But we'll circle back to it.
Yep. The Panda hired Rob Talbot as their new executive director. Rob Talbot of Heartwood Center and Maddox Farms Productions. And that will be, that made the Reader as well. Mm-hmm. They've been looking for a new executive director for a little while. And I think Rob Talbot has the qualifications, and it's nice to see that go to somebody local, at least in my opinion. Somebody who's already here, I guess I should say. The big news that we've continued talking about is the Russell Sports Complex development and what's going on at City Hall. We talked about that last week, kind of anticipating that there would be more to talk about this week, but there isn't much. Andy Grote issued just a very short statement to the media, kind of saying that there would be no further comment from him.
The councilman who resigned last week. Yeah.
Right.
And I am not aware of any further developments out at Traverse Park or any talk of them changing the schedule or changing the location or anything like that following that dramatic meeting of last Wednesday.
Yeah, I think they're proceeding with the project to build a new sports center there.
Yeah. The big story in the Sandpoint Reader, at least, is all about the fire department, and that is Zach's coverage of a nice little pun in the title, I thought, was "We're Burned Out." Selkirk fire personnel speak out on staffing shortage and call for change in leadership. And we'll want to get into the details of that in just a moment after we play our Sandpoint sound. Am I missing anything? Any big stories that we...
Well, you missed one of the biggest.
Oh, no. What'd I do?
We have state champions in our town again. The Sandpoint girls soccer team won state championship. They beat their nemesis, Bishop Kelly. Been coming down to those two teams, seems like, many times over the years. And it sounded like it was pretty dramatic. They had a goal in the first half from Aaliyah Strock, and it was tied up at 1-1. And then with time running out, Marlee McCrum put in the dagger, and they won the game 2-1. So that was a dramatic turn of events on Saturday. The Sandpoint boys soccer team made it all the way to the state championship, even though they were only seeded 6. They faced the tourney number 1 seed, Wood River, and they fell 3-1. But great seasons for both the girls and the boys soccer this year.
I think that on CP at 3, Cedar Post at 3, which airs on this radio station on Thursdays at 3, they actually had an interview with a few of the players, or at least one of the players from the Sandpoint, the girls soccer team. Yeah. And that will air again on tomorrow night at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, so people could hear what the girls had to say there. That'd be cool.
And you can find that online as well. Elections coming up, of course, and that is still there's going to be a candidates forum on Monday hosted by the Daily Bee, and that's going to be out at the library.
At the library, East Bonner County Library. Mm-hmm. A couple things to note there. The elections are November 7th, so we're only, a week and a half away now from Election Day. The last day to request an absentee ballot is today. You got to do that today, folks. If you need to vote absentee, you can request that via voteidaho.gov. I believe is the website. You can actually ask for that online. It has to be returned in the hands of the Bonner County Election Office by November 7th, 8 p.m. when the polls close. So if you do want to vote absentee, you got to make sure you get it back in time. If you put it in the mail, may or may not get there in time. And we're going to have an interview with Mike Rosedale on this coming Wednesday's morning show. He's going to be talking about that in a little bit more. He's the county our chief election officer and the county clerk. And right now, early voting is underway at the county building on Highway 200. So if you're in any of the cities, the municipalities, the school districts that have elections going on, that you can vote early right now through next Friday, November 3rd, and then Election Day is November 7th.
Okay. What I was just looking for was, I think there's also a meet and greet for candidates out in Hope for those of us on the east side of the lake, which you might be listening out that way. And that might be the closest place for you to meet your candidates.
This particular election, this kind of off-year election for cities and school districts, you have to live within the district boundaries to be able to vote. So I don't get a vote because I'm just outside. No. Are you inside this the city limits, Jack?
I'm not. I'm not voting in the city election either. I don't think I'm in any contested election.
Well, neither am I. But I will say the folks in East Hope get a vote on their own city council. There's a contested race there. Mm-hmm. They also get a vote on the school district, Zone 1, because they're in Zone 1. That's the only school election we have in the Lake Pend Oreille School District. And they might even get a vote. There's a Selkirk Fire District election that's contested as well. So those folks have stuff to vote on.
Yes.
Hope, East Hope.
That is certainly true. Let's see here. I'm going to play now a little something. It's not much.
The Sandpoint Sound.
The Sandpoint Sound is just recorded on my telephone. So we'll see what we think about this. That's pretty much the most exciting part of it. It goes on like that.
Well, we could take a wild guess at what that was. I think we all experienced it, right?
Yeah. It got cold this week.
And windy.
And snowy.
And snowy.
Yeah. It was an interesting week for the first snowfall because it was cool to look out and see the snow. But then if you have young children, it was not a very fun day to go out and like play in the snow. So it was mostly just, we can look at it. We can step outside for a minute. And then
there really wasn't enough to play in. You couldn't barely make a snowball out of that.
No. Right.
No, but it looked a little different. So that was fun. And I think finally we can say summer's over.
Yeah,
it seems like.
And with Halloween coming up, it's going to stay cool, but not quite as cool.
That's right. And the forecast is for no precipitation on Halloween, at least. So it will be a dry, if cold, day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Zach, I think the time has come to talk about your a huge, sprawling piece in The Reader. I think the first question is, when did you kind of start reporting on this? It looks like it probably goes back more than a month that you've been working on this.
It was more than a month. Yeah, that city council meeting of September 20th was where my kind of ears pricked up on this issue. And as I say in the piece, two of the firefighters in the department got up during the public forum section of the September 20 meeting. And that's, the beginning part of the meeting where people can kind of bring whatever they want to bring before the council. And that was one of those meetings that kind of leading up to the big controversies around the James E. Russell Sports Center, some of the protest activity. This was predating that a bit. So a lot of the comment was about that issue, but sort of sandwiched in between all that other testimony were these two firefighters who got up and read very brief statements. I think I looked at it again. It was under 2 minutes each, and just kind of laid it out saying that, we have a big problem with retention at the Selkirk Fire Department. We're losing really good people to other departments. We're getting to the point where it's affecting our ability to, function. And they said that, the reason that they're giving for that is, higher pay elsewhere, but also they feel like there is a lack of leadership at the joint powers agreement level. So the JPA, which manages the Selkirk Fire as a combination of, Westside, Sagal, and Sandpoint fire departments. So there's an executive director of the JPA, which sort of is the governing body for those departments, acting as one. And that's, of course, City Administrator Jennifer Stapleton serves in that position. So they were calling for a change in her position. They don't want her to be in charge of that anymore. And that was kind of where they sort of left it. They brought the issue up and then they sat back down and everybody kind of moved on. But I found that to be kind of shocking a little bit, to see members of the fire department get up and speak publicly like that. So I started following up on it, shortly after that meeting and did a couple of interviews with some of the firefighters who decided that they wanted to go public about their concerns. And, spoke with Chief Gavin Gilcrease, and Jennifer Stapleton to kind of get their side of all that. And that was the resulting piece. took about a month, took about three pages. And I don't know that anyone's really happy with that story, but maybe that's a sign that it was a good story.
Have you gotten feedback from the two sides on it?
I spoke with some of the firefighters, and you know, they were happy that, you know, their concerns got out there. But you know, I think it's an uncomfortable topic for everyone. And it's, you know, frankly, some of the stuff they were telling me was kind of alarming. You know, to hear that we've lost so many firefighters, so many of them with, you know, 20 years of experience in the department. Folks that were, you know, close to being retirement, you know, are retiring early. Three of the guys that I spoke with, the three main sources in my piece were Clint Frank, who's a, you know, head of the union. I spoke with Jake Hilton, who's been a firefighter here in town for close to 31 years. And Jeff Calhoun, who's been a firefighter for about 11 years. Clint and Jake are both contemplating seriously retiring next year. And that would be ahead of their normal retirement time. Jeff is talking about, you know, within the next 3 years retiring. So between those three, that's a lot of experience. And they're not the only ones, you know, who were going elsewhere. And when I talked to, you know, Stapleton and Gilcrease, they chalk this up to sort of macroeconomic trends. You know, we've seen it across the economy and across, you know, sectors, both private and public, where during the pandemic, especially, people were on the move. Like they were leaving jobs they'd had for a long time, you know, taking new directions. Pay in a lot of sectors of the economy increased dramatically during the COVID time. So that was a draw for sure. Some of our surrounding fire departments in like Kootenai County and Spokane are expanding because they're experiencing, you know, explosive growth like we are. But those jurisdictions are better funded, so those jobs do pay substantially more than we pay here. So that's an attraction for sure. But, you know, the firefighters I spoke with, they also say, well, I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, people are going to other places to make more money, but they're also going to other places because they don't like the way the department's being managed. And they feel that there's a lack of autonomy. One of the complaints that comes up over and over again in separate conversations with these people is, you know, they feel micromanaged. They don't feel like they have the authority to, you know, make decisions that they feel like need to be made at the sort of department level, the day-to-day stuff. So they chafe at, you know, some of the policies and directives that they're getting from the top of the JPA. They also feel like, you know, they're not being listened to in many cases about the concerns they have regarding staffing. They don't feel particularly safe going out on some calls because they don't have the backup that they feel like they need. Something that didn't make it into the piece, but sort of is alluded to, is, you know, the national standards that we have for fire protection. And, you know, the standards are really guidelines, which is mentioned in the piece. But I think if I'm remembering correctly, the document that I got to look at from the national fire standards was, we should probably have about 17 firefighters, you know, given our size and the kinds of things that we deal with here. Well, we only have 9. And that's
over all three fire districts, Westside, yeah, Sagal.
That's if everybody's fully staffed, is about 9. Mm-hmm. But as they point out, you know, if anybody's out on leave, if somebody's off duty, on any given day, you can expect about 6 firefighters are active in the district. Mm-hmm. And the district is 194 square miles and covers between 30 and 35,000 people. So they feel like that's, you know, very understaffed. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of that is, you know, a study that was done in 2020, the Fitch study. It's an emergency response study that the three different agencies paid $45,000 each to get this study done. It didn't recommend that we needed to expand. And that's what, you know, Jennifer Stapleton and Chief Gilcrease both said when I talked to them. It's like, look, I mean, we know we have to add people at some point, but the documents we're going off, you know, the Fitch study is not telling us that that's now. Like, we don't need to expand right now. That said, with the departure of these folks, I think we've lost something like 6 firefighters in the last year and a half, 2 years, and 4 in the last 6 months. We are trying to fill 2 positions right now. And Chief Gilcrease told me that I think they had about 42, 45, something like that. Mm-hmm. More than 40 applicants already for those 2 jobs. So, yeah,
those kind of jobs are highly sought after.
Right. Yeah.
Can we go back and just define, for those who don't know, the JPA? And when did this start, and what is that structure? I think I knew, for example, that, you know, if you call 911, obviously there's some sort of agreement between the different fire districts in the area to determine who goes out on a call and stuff like that. But how are they organized?
Right. So in 2015 is when the JPA was created.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was created with the idea that, you know, you look at this 194 square mile area, mm-hmm. you know, full of, you know, 35-ish thousand people now. I mean, it wasn't that big in 2015, but, you know, we had a lot of population increase. Mm-hmm. So even in 2015, they're looking at this big area with a lot of people sort of scattered around. Mm-hmm. We had these different fire districts that were operating, you know, sort of on their own. And operationally, that's difficult in a big space like that. So the Joint Powers Agreement came into play first between Sandpoint and Westside. No, Sandpoint and Sagal. Sandpoint and Sagal were the first to kind of come together under the JPA in 2015. Mm-hmm. And it's basically just like a resource sharing agreement. You know, they share the chief. They can move people back and forth between these different stations that they have. There's two stations in the Sagal Fire District. You know, there's Sagal Fire and then there's Kerrywood. So they have those two stations. We have, you know, Sandpoint Station Number 1 down at City Hall. Mm-hmm. So
I think Westside is in Dover.
Yeah, yeah. Westside is Dover and Renco. So they joined in 2016. So it's kind of been an iterative process. You know, you start with these two agencies, and then, you know, a third joins in 2016. Northside doesn't belong, but they have an agreement. It isn't part of the JPA to go help out with Northside and vice versa. So they aren't in the JPA yet. I've been told there's talk of it, but mm-hmm. Northside's still a little bit leery of joining. And, you know, there's lots of reasons for that. I didn't get into that in the piece. But mm-hmm. So the JPA is basically, like I say, a resource sharing agreement. Their finances are all kept separate. So the way I understand it anyway, if somebody in Sagal or Westside, you know, if those folks want to buy something or, you know, make an expenditure or whatever, that has to go through Sandpoint. Sandpoint sends a bill and then they get their stuff. So while the finances are all kept separate, you know, there's a board of commissioners that, you know, that sort of oversee the JPA. There's, of course, Jennifer Stapleton as the executive director. She doesn't have any votes. You know, she's mm-hmm. she's in an administrative role. But there's, you know, two city council members, I believe, on there. There's a member of the community, and then there's representatives from the fire districts themselves. And they meet, you know, once a month. You can watch their meetings on the, you know, City of Sandpoint's website. They post them on YouTube like they do the city council meetings mm-hmm. after the fact. And they just, you know, they manage affairs for all three of these different districts, mm-hmm. and that's how that works.
And so the Jennifer Stapleton is, what, the chair of the JPA? What's her officials?
I think she's the executive director, but, you know, she's also kind of the chair, I think is what they also refer to her as in mm-hmm. that position.
Is she executive director just by virtue of being the city administrator, or is it something that you get voted into?
As I understand it, you know, the JPA was created in 2015 and then expanded in 2016. And then at one point, Sandpoint came to the JPA and said, you know, we need to move all these people under one sort of employment umbrella. And it needs to be Sandpoint because we're the multipurpose government. You know, these fire districts aren't governments. You know, Sandpoint's different in the JPA in that it's a city. And the fire department is part of the city's operations. Now, Westside and Sagal are their own districts. So it made sense to the JPA, you know, at that time that Sandpoint should sort of take the lead role. So first among equals, kind of, put all the firefighters under sort of one employment group in Sandpoint. And then Jennifer Stapleton, as city administrator, sort of became, you know, it made sense to have her at the top of that organizational chart mm-hmm. if it's going to be one employee group. Now, when they call for a change of leadership, what I was led to believe is that, you know, the chair, Jennifer, would have to decide to leave that position. I don't know what the voting structure is like there. So that's kind of what they're wanting is they're asking, like, please, you know, step down, let's get a new executive director. And that may be discussed in their contract negotiations, which are coming up next March. You know, the union, they're one of the only sectors of employment in the state that are sort of guaranteed unionization. So they have a, you know, contract negotiation every 3 to 4 years. Last one, I think, was 2021, which is sort of where they would trace some of the problems they're having too, was that last round of negotiations where, among other things, it was decided to get rid of battalion chiefs, which is a, you know, sort of a link in the chain of command where previously it would be the chief of the fire services at the top. Then you have an assistant chief. And then you have battalion chiefs, and the battalion chiefs, as I understand it from the org chart, are they sort of act under the chief directly, but sort of adjacent to the assistant chief. And their job is to kind of be the sort of on the ground leader for each one of these districts. And they would be, you know, kind of the person that advocates for the frontline firefighters, you know, when they talk to management. You know, they would have a range of sort of leadership roles in the field. Well, those went away in 2021 and was replaced with a chief and a deputy chief. And this is a complaint that, you know, all these firefighters that I spoke with have, is that they missed those battalion chiefs because they felt like they had another link in the chain of command that they could work with. And now they're sort of isolated. They feel that management is sort of siloed away from them. And so their concerns aren't being heard, or they're being ignored, or, you know, they feel a lack of investment, I guess, maybe in the management structure, and they want those battalion chiefs back. But, you know, that's going to be part of the negotiations. mm-hmm. So that's one of the things they regret is losing that in their last contract. And they did sign the contract. But, you know, they now look back at that and say that was probably not the best move, and they want to change it.
So I think it boils down to safety questions here. For the firefighters themselves, they're stretched thin, and as you indicate in the story, they'll be making calls with very little backup.
Right.
And the response time for them to get backup, where they could actually you know, have some measure of safety on their own behalf, is could be 10 or 15 minutes before more help arrived. And then, of course, from the citizen side, if a fire truck arrives and they don't have enough personnel, they can't necessarily get in to do some of the, you know, save lives or
right.
combat the fire like they need to.
Yeah, the traditional standard for response on, you know, like a big, like a structure fire or something, from what I was told, is, you know, two in, two out is what they say. And that's, you know, two firefighters outside, you know, kind of watching the two firefighters that go in. Mm-hmm. And we've never had the proper staffing, apparently, in this area to properly follow that. And again, it's a guideline, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not required by law or anything. Mm-hmm. So we've had, you know, kind of three would be the typical, you know, in the past. But now with the loss of staffing, they're going to these fires and sometimes it's one person on an engine. And that's, I mean, the chief says that's not a good idea. Nobody likes that idea of sending one firefighter out to an incident like that. So they sit around, you know, they kind of set up the scene and then they wait. Mm-hmm. And the numbers that I kept hearing from, you know, multiple times from these different conversations was, you know, you could be 12 to 18 minutes before somebody shows up with the adequate staffing to actually respond to the fire. And that's an awful lot of time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they don't like that. And they want that to change.
Especially if somebody's life is in danger. So I do know there's pretty well-organized volunteer firefighter, I guess it's organization that supplements these professionals. Does that play into this at all? Are they looking for more volunteers to help with this?
I think they would always want more volunteers. I didn't get into that too much. It did come up in conversation, but, you know, it didn't make it into the piece. But from what I understand, you know, the volunteer program has always been active, but I don't think it's very robust right now. Mm. And I think they would probably like to see that change too. So, I mean, the more help, the better always. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, volunteers don't have the level of training that the professionals.
Yeah, I mean, these guys. I mean, again, we're talking about people with, you know, more than a decade, up to, you know, 20, 30 years of experience. So these are highly trained specialists in what they do. And it should be noted also, you know, the structure fire incident response. We don't have a lot of fires like that here, so a lot of what they do is, you know, non fire emergencies. They do a lot of medical calls. You know, accident response, stuff like that. So I think it's good to bear in mind, you know, that when they're talking about some of this incident response, they're not always talking about fires. Mm-hmm. Those are just the most sort of dramatic and potentially life-threatening incidents. But, you know, when they go out on any kind of call, and as they would say, you know, in the piece, they get sent out on a medical call, there's nothing to say that they're not going to get called to a fire mm-hmm. along the way. Mm-hmm. And they have to be prepared at all times for the worst case scenario, which is, you know, a fire that requires a rescue. So that's one of the things they're worried about as well, is with the lack of staffing and how they feel sort of operationally stretched. They don't like the idea of going out on a medical call without the stuff they need to respond potentially to a fire and to a rescue. And that's something that they have also felt pretty upset about and frustrated, is that there've been some directives in the past that they felt like hampered their ability to pivot away from a medical call, for instance, and then into a fire. And one of the examples they gave here in the piece was a church caught on fire in the summer. And there were some firefighters that were out on a medical call, and they were, had been told to bring a certain type of truck that didn't have water on it when they're responding to a medical. And that was, they were like, well, that's kind of iffy. You know, if we go out on a call with something we don't have water, like maybe we're going to get called to a fire and then we're going to show up and we're not going to have any water. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. They got a call for this church that was on fire. It was a small fire. And we probably all remember when that happened. So they had to go out there with this truck that didn't have any water on it. And they fought the fire with a 2.5 gallon water can, which, you know, they carry on everything.
And a garden hose, I suppose.
And a garden hose.
Yeah.
And that was not ideal for them. It worked. I mean, they got the fire out. They saved the building. It wasn't a huge fire. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I asked the chief about that incident, and he said, well, yeah, I mean, it was a small fire, and that's kind of what we would do, you know, in that case. He didn't seem to think that was a particularly dramatic, you know, sort of crisis. But mm-hmm. the firefighters I spoke with said, well, I mean, it's indicative of the larger problem. I mean, thank God it didn't go bad.
Yeah,
you know, but who's to say that, you know, it wouldn't have been a bigger fire or, you know, something else might have transpired in there that would have, they'd been left without the proper equipment and they wouldn't have been able to respond to it effectively. Mm-hmm. But in that case, we got lucky. And that's sort of how the article ends, right, is, you know, firefighter Jake Hilton, he says, we've been very lucky here over the years, and it has everything to do with the training and the dedication of the firefighters. But that's not to say that we're going to keep staying lucky, mm-hmm. and we need to solve this problem of staffing, they say.
Mm-hmm. So we're about out of time, but I'm curious about what happens next here. They came before the city council and aired these grievances about several weeks ago. Does the council get involved on this, or what happens next?
Well, I mean, there are two council members that serve on the JPA board, and, you know, these firefighters obviously brought their grievances to the full council, and, you know, they've been talking to these members of the JPA board, so, I mean, they're aware. I know the city's aware of these problems, and they're definitely aware of it now. Mm-hmm. I think that what happens next is they continue to sort of do what they've been doing. I guess, you know, these two positions that we're hiring for hopefully get filled soon. And then they go into their contract negotiations next spring. And that might be when, you know, some of these larger issues are really addressed. I mean, for now, they're just trying to make people aware of the issue and what they perceive to be, you know, going wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's up to the JPA and it's up to the, you know, the management structure to address those or not address those. Or, yeah, I mean, I guess we'll have to wait till March, I think, next year is when the new contract will come down. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's some in-depth journalism right there in the Reader this week, which is out right now. People want to pick that up.
Mm-hmm. We are about out of time. It caught my eye that the last time the fire department actually grew, the Sandpoint Fire Department, was in 2002.
Yeah, that was Clint Frank's hire was, I think, the last time that we had a new position created. Every other hire we've done since then has been, you know, sort of backfilling vacancies.
So right now, is it considered fully staffed with 9 and they're expanding it to 11 with 2 more hires? Or
that's a little unclear to me. I don't know. I don't necessarily know that it would be new positions. They may be. Mm-hmm. That was something I didn't quite get to, but I just know that we've had, you know, the 6 that have left in the last year and a half to 2, and then the 4 in the last 6 months. We have to refill those positions for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's a 3 pages in the Sandpoint Reader, more than usual.
Right.
I would say this is a long story and well covered. We are out of time, as always. Anything else in closing? Do we miss anything?
Happy Halloween.
Yeah. Stay warm.
And stay warm, yeah.
I queued up a little something to go out with. Okay, we will say thanks and tune in next week for more.
Yeah, we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening, folks.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening.